Well, welcome to the funeral. Socialism is dead. Communism is dead. Marxism, of course, is very dead. How do I know this? Well, I know it because I read it every day in the newspapers. I hear it every day on the radio. I see it every day on the television. You hear it every day, of course, in these temples of learning, which are the universities. Everybody's agreed that socialism is as dead as a doornail. Now, you see, when I hear this kind of argument, it reminds me of a certain man that you may have heard of by the name of Joseph Goebbels. You heard of Goebbels? Goebbels was Hitler's minister of propaganda. Very intelligent man, real bastard, but an intelligent bastard. They're the worst sort, you see. And Goebbels said the following. He's no fool. He said the following. If you want to tell a lie, please don't tell a little lie. Little lies are no good. You don't have a waste of time. Tell a big lie. You know, the bigger the better. And if you think of a big lie, and you repeat it, and you repeat it, and you repeat it, eventually people will come to believe it. Now, you see, I'm rather a skeptical person. Skepticism is not a bad thing within certain limits. And the first thought that occurs to my skeptical mind is this. Why? Why do they bother? If socialism is dead, Marxism is dead, why do they continually repeat and repeat and repeat? Leave it alone. Even Jesus Christ said, let the dead bury their dead. Leave it alone. If it's dead, why bother with it? You see, now I can believe many things about the ruling class, about the imperialists, about the capitalists. There's one thing I do not believe. I do not believe that they are stupid. Okay? And I do not believe for a single moment that they would dedicate such a lot of time, such colossal time and effort and money to argue against an idea that is dead. I don't believe it. Rather, I prefer to believe that the ruling class will only attack an idea that's very much alive, that is very relevant, and that is very dangerous. And believe you me, ladies and gentlemen, comrades and friends, socialism, by which I mean Marxism, in my opinion, is scientific socialism. I speak here as a Marxist, self-confessed. I'm proud of it. All my life I've been a Marxist. I see nothing to persuade me to the contrary. If anyone here can persuade me to the contrary, they're very, very welcome. I'll listen to them with the greatest of interest. Now let's start, with your permission, I would like to start with a little challenge. Now we're here in this wonderful, I've never been here before, this wonderful modern university. I'm sure it's got wonderful facilities. We see all these eager faces of people dedicated to the pursuit of truth and the advancement of human knowledge. And I dare say that in this wonderful temple of learning, there must be a library. Is there, Alex? Is there a library on the premises?
I should imagine so, yeah.
You would imagine? So good heavens
above. Yeah, of course.
Somebody, is it a library?
Yes.
You
yes.
See? For a moment I was getting worried. There is a library, Alex. You come to the right place. There is a library. Is it a good library?
Yes.
Qualified. I'm sure it's an excellent library. Okay. The challenge is this. Tomorrow morning, because it's probably shut now, go to the library. Take out any bourgeois book. I don't care which book it is or what subject it is, written 150 years ago, and I will tell you in advance, this book will merely have an historic interest. Application to the modern world, zero, or close to zero. That's the first step. Now I'll make another challenge. You go to the library and pick up the Communist Manifesto, written by Marx and Engels, over 150 years ago, 1848, two young men, And I think you'll have a surprise. First of all, if you haven't read it, you'll have a big surprise. If you have read it, read it again. You still have a surprise. Because here is a book written over 150 years ago, which is entirely modern and contemporary, and is in point of fact more contemporary now than when it was written. Because here's a book, which is an astounding thing. Please do not take my word for anything that is being said. You check it out for yourself, please. But here is a book written 150 years ago, which does not describe the world of 150 years ago at all. It describes the world of today. And it describes the world of today in the most striking detail, down to the finest details. For example, have we got any economists present? No? Nobody's willing to own up to this. There's a brave chap that owns up to being an economist, a pursuer of the dismal science, as it is known. Well, you know, the economists tell us, and no doubt they tell you in your lectures and tutorials, that globalization is a new invention. This is the thing. It's an entirely new model idea which they've invented in the last 20 years. Not so. Not so at all. Marx and Engels explained and predicted globalization 150 years ago. They explained that the capitalist system develops in the first instance as a national market. You know, Britain and so on, later on. Germany, France, later on America, so on, develops as a national market, but inevitably, he predicted, it would tend to create a world market. And the most important aspect of the 21st century is precisely the crushing domination of the world market, a world economy, against which no nation, really speaking, can stand. You want proof of that? Take with the fate of Russia to the Soviet Union. That was, after all, a vast country, a subcontinent. But it was forced to submit eventually to the pressures of capitalism and has been absorbed into the world market. Same thing has happened with China. These are huge countries, huge economies. The crushing domination of world trade and the world economy is the most important detail, the most important fact of our life, which was explained in advance and predicted in advance by Marx and Engels in this marvellous book which I'm describing. So let's take another element. Monopoly. Now again, as an economist, what's your name, sorry?
Andrew.
As an economist, you will know that the line is, the party line is, it isn't only Marxists that have got a party line. The bourgeois have got a party line as well. The party line of the economist is approximately as follows. Small is beautiful. You hear that expression? Small, in other words, the future is not big state-owned enterprises, it's small little businesses set up with energy and with entrepreneurs, a French word, of course, although George W. doesn't know that, doesn't know many things, set up by people eager to make advance the wealth of society and all the rest of it, you know. Small is beautiful. Now, my wife is small. She's Spanish and she's very beautiful. But that's really nothing to do with it. We're not talking about aesthetics. We're talking about economics. And if what is meant is that the small businesses rule okay, I'm here to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, not so. Not so. Absolute and complete balderdash. Marx and Engels predicted, in their day it was true, in their day they were mainly small enterprises, even in Britain. In France, up until the recent period, there were small businesses and so on. In the States, they started off with small businesses, naturally, talking about the 19th century. But that ain't the case now in the States, is it? The entire American economy is completely dominated by a handful of super, vast industrial and financial conglomerations. Huge monopolies. The entire economy of the world, this world market, which we started by describing, is currently dominated by no more than 200 gigantic enterprises. The Fords, the General Motors, Mitsubishis, you name it. The banks, of course. We'll come to the banks in a moment. It's entirely dominated. In other words, what we have is a colossal concentration of capital. They try to argue the contrary. Oh, no, it's all little businesses. They even go so far as to say, we're all middle class now. Have you heard that one? We're all middle class now. You try and tell the people in the Congo that we're all middle class now, or even in the States. No, the argument is that, on the contrary, there's an enormous polarization. It is brutal. The world has never seen anything like this. Marx predicted this, but really speaking, it's like a laboratory expression of the predictions which you'll find in the Communist Manifesto. In all countries, particularly the United States, but also in Britain, France, everywhere else, an enormous polarization, a concentration of capital, of wealth, of power, into fewer and fewer hands. And on the other hand, as Marx also explained, an enormous increase of poverty, of suffering, of hunger. Just look at the position. I want you to think for a moment about the real position of the world in the first decade of the 21st century. It is an extraordinary period to live in. It's a very exciting period. Here, you know, humankind has within its grasp for the first time a real possibility of solving all the fundamental problems of the human race. We have the objective possibility of solving hunger, of disease, of illiteracy. You know, if I don't know if any Christians present, you know, I'm not a Christian myself, but I have read the Bible. Very good book, very interesting, very wise book, many good things in the Bible. I was a bit disappointed with the ending, that's all. That's a separate matter. The Bible says, Jesus Christ says, the poor are always with us. And when he said that, it was true. When Jesus Christ was up 2,000 years ago, even 100 years ago, if there was a famine, if the harvest failed, people died of hunger. Nothing could be done about it. It was inevitable. It was an act of God. You just die of hunger. So what? You see, that is no longer true. I'm here to tell you the following. In the world as it is today, never mind about the future socialist utopia, I'm talking about now. The actual potential that exists of what we call the productive forces, that is to say, agriculture, industry, technology, and science, is more than sufficient to solve the problem. We can say for the first time in history, it is possible to affirm without fear of contradiction, there is no need for anybody to die of hunger. There's no need for it. Absolutely no need. There's plenty of course, we get people say, oh no, but the resources are limited and so on. Not so. And not so. Look, in the United States of America, you probably know this. For a start, it's a complete racket, this so-called free enterprise, you know, the big American dream. The American farmers are subsidized up to here, costing billions of dollars out of the American budget. They subsidize the big farmers, by the way, in the main. It's big business, agro-business, not to produce food. In America, food has been shoveled into the sea, it's been destroyed, it's been burned, or farmers are paid not to produce food. The latest abomination is this business of producing, what do they call it? It's supposed to be green. Oh, they're all green now, by the way. Brown is green. Is that possible for brown to be green? I don't know. Bush is green. They're all green. They're all ecologists now. They all want to save the planet. In the States, they're producing this ethanol, which is a criminal thing. It does nothing to save the planet whatsoever, because the amount of pollution which they do and the amount of carbon emissions in order to produce the ethanol is more than what they save to begin with. Secondly, they're using maize, corn, which should be used to feed people and animals. They're using it to produce this ethanol, which is heavily subsidized, which goes straight into the pockets of agro-businesses, big agro-business in the States. As a result of this, by the way, we can get more hunger. Even in Italy, now never mind about Sudan and so on, they just increased the price of pasta by 20%. Because there's a shortage now of the grain, which is required for the production even of pasta, but that's a separate matter. In Europe, in the common market, it's now known as the EU, there's a huge production of food. They produce, there's not too little food, there's too much food. Too much food. In Europe, in Britain, farmers are paid not to produce food. A few years ago, I don't know whether it still exists, I've not seen the latest figures, but I can guarantee you, check the figures for yourself. A few years ago, there was what they call a mountain of grain in the common market. A mountain of grain, which they couldn't sell at a suitable price. Okay? So what did they do with the grain? They mixed it with a blue colorant, which made it unfit for human or animal consumption. Did you know this? No. It doesn't appear in the front page of the newspapers. Fact, nonetheless. They had a mountain of butter. They had a mountain of sugar. Particularly criminal from my point of view, they had a lake of wine. I mean, I like wine. But they were turning this into alcohol, into industrial alcohol, because they could not sell it at a suitable price. In Spain, I know Spain very well, I live in Spain, my wife is Spanish, they are tearing up olive groves. Thousands and thousands of which it takes a long time for an olive tree to grow. And olive oil is very good for your health, as you find out. They're tearing it up. Complete vandalism. Why? They have the physical means to produce vast amount of food for people can eat, but it does not make the necessary profit for big business. And under the capitalist system, it is a system which is geared for the profits of a few and not for the needs of society. That is the essence of the problem. That's one side of it. You have obscene riches. Someone like Bill Gates, the man who doesn't know what to do with his billions, it's not millions. And people like that. By the way, the richest man in the world today is not Bill Gates. You know who it is? It's a man called Carlos Slim. You never heard of Carlos Slim? He's a Mexican. I was in Mexico a few months ago. There are very poor people in Mexico. The richest man in the world is a Mexican. A speculator. He's one of these operators that bases on construction. Real estate. Produces not an atom of wealth for the benefit of humanity. Obscene wealth on the one hand, I could catalogue that fact, and obscene poverty on the other extreme. In the year of our Lord, 2007, according to the figures of the United Nations, there are 1.2 billion people living in poverty, by which I mean less than $2 a day. Could you live on less than $2 a day? I've seen it. I travel a lot. I go to Pakistan. So I see this. 1.2 billion people living in these conditions. Which is quite unnecessary. Incidentally, of these 1.2 billion people, 8 million die every year because they do not have sufficient material means to stay alive. 8 million people per year, men, women, and children. Now, you've all heard of the Holocaust, of Hitler's Holocaust, isn't it? That where 6 million people were killed, mainly Jews, not only Jews. Also communists, socialists, trade unionists, gypsies. 6 million people were killed in the concentration camps. This is normally portrayed, quite rightly, as a crime against humanity. Okay? But here you have a silent Holocaust which murders 8 million people, innocent people, every year, and nobody says anything about it. And you know the worst thing about this is this. It is not necessary. It is not necessary for anybody to die of hunger. It is not necessary for any child to be without a school. It is not necessary for any family to be without a house in the world. We have all the means to solve these problems. Why are they not solved? This is the question. Why are they not solved? How does it come about, even in advanced countries like Britain, with a classes of 30 kids. I was once a school teacher myself. I can guarantee you, what sort of education can you give a class of 30 kids? You spend all your time keeping order, keeping them quiet, keeping them amused. You can't educate these kids. And that's why many people in Britain are illiterate, which is a shocking state of affairs. And yet there are unemployed teachers. Why? Why are there unemployed teachers? You see, you say the money's not there. The money is there, but of course the money is put to other purposes. What other were the purposes of enrichment of a few people, speculation, and so on and so forth. Of course, you might argue, yes, but this is private enterprise. Everyone requires private enterprise. Without private enterprise, everything would seize up. Everything would be spoiled. They probably tell you in economics, this is the key. You know, it's the invisible hand of the market. To quote Adam Smith. Now, it quite amuses me, this argument. And I can answer that very quickly by quoting just one example. Okay? And it's not the Soviet Union. We can discuss that also. There's also big advantages in the Soviet Union if it comes to that. On the basis of a nationalized planned economy. Now they all say, oh, no, it doesn't work, it failed. So yes, it failed. What failed in the Soviet Union was not socialism or communism in any sense that would have been understood by Marx, Engels, Lenin, or Trotsky, or the Bolshevik Party. Okay? What failed in the Soviet Union, it did fail, was a grotesque, bureaucratic and totalitarian caricature of socialism. That's what failed. Instantly, socialism, let me make my position clear, socialism must be democratic. Socialism must, by its very nature, not for sentimental reasons, I can go to the reason why it should be democratic, it must be democratic, it must involve the active participation, the control, the participation in management, which you don't have at the present time, Britain, America, or anywhere else. I argue that it's not a genuine democracy. Okay, in Britain, well, what sort of democracy you got? You've got two parties here which have the same policies, more or less, although I support the Labour Party. I've been a member of the Labour Party for many years. But by God, under this leadership, they're pursuing policies which are literally indistinguishable from the Tories. Look at what happened yesterday in the House of Commons. In the States, you've got, what do they call them? The Republicrats and the Democrats.
Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah, but they're the same.
Yeah, they really are.
It's one party. In effect, it's a one-party state. People are just fooled into thinking. So you vote in an election, and so on and so forth. Okay, you vote to get them in. But you see, the people that really decide what happens in Britain, America, and so on, is not the government. It is the banks, the monopolies, the big industry. They decide, in effect, what happens. And of course, there's no question of democratic control there. But let's go back to what I was saying. How can one demonstrate the superiority of planning, which I stand for a nationalized planned economy? Well, let me take an example. In Britain, in 1940, when things were really serious, Hitler had conquered the whole of Europe, practically. The British Army were heavily defeated. They had to flee from the beaches in Dunkirk. And people were terrified that Hitler would arrive in Britain at any time, which was a real possibility. What did they do? Did they say, oh, just a minute, free enterprise, girls and boys, let everyone do what they want. You know, the market will decide, everything will come out okay, everything will be fine. That's the argument, isn't it? That's what they say, the invisible hand of the market, private enterprise. Did they say that? No, they did not. They centralized the economy. They had worked out a plan, a rough plan. It wasn't a genuine source, but it was a plan. They introduced the direction of labor. Okay? They introduced planning. They nationalized industries that were to do with the war. Why did they do that? I'll tell you why. Because they know that it gives better results than the anarchy of private ownership. It gives better results. Otherwise, you can't explain what they did in 1940. Can't explain. If it is true that private enterprise works better, why did they do this? As a matter of fact, it is not true. It's not true at all. Private enterprise, my central thesis is that capitalism, you're not allowed to say capitalism anymore. It's a rude word. You must say the free market economy. Don't say capitalism anymore. You must say, now you study English, you know what Shakespeare said, don't you? A rose with any other name will smell as sweet. Yes, and certain other natural substances with another name will smell as bad. It's capitalism. Let's call a spade a shovel. It's capitalism, for goodness sake. Same system that's been around for the last 200 years. So, you know, the argument is that this is a superior system. Francis Fukuyama, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, actually went so far as to say, they talked about the end of socialism, end of communism, end of Marxism. Francis Fukuyama actually went so far as to say, it's the end of history. Any history students here? Yes, you can leave now, because history's finished, you know. History's over. Well, to be fair, you can write it in your exam paper. No, history's finished, so don't bother me with this bullshit. I wonder what would happen. You can try it. No, to be fair to Francis Fukuyama, to be fair to Mr. Fukuyama, he did not actually mean that history itself is finished. What he meant to say was something different. What he meant to say is that the class struggle is finished. The struggle between capitalism and socialism is finished. And that capitalism has won, and therefore there can only be one possible system. Margaret Thatcher said the same thing, you know, Tina, there is no alternative. You know? And if you accept that, then of course the history is finished, isn't it? You can argue about this or that detail, but fundamentally, within this capitalist system, for forever and ever, amen. Well, you know, I don't accept that. I consider it to be profoundly unscientific, unhistorical, and untrue. You see, people actually believe that capitalism's always existed. It's an astonishing thing, you know, even quite educated people, they really believe this. You even see it in the movies. Have you seen the film The Flintstones? Was it Before Your Time? No, nobody ever heard of the Flintstones.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, there isn't it. Now, before anyone says anything, look, I do possess a sense of humour. You know, the Marxists do have, some of us anyway, have got a sense of humour. And I do realise that the film is supposed to be funny. Okay, I do accept that. And yet, people, you know, here's a picture of human society as it was, a million years ago or whatever, right? And you have private property, and you have money, and you have banks, and you have policemen, and you have judges, and you have prisons, and you have the bourgeois family, where the man is oppressed by the woman, just like now. You know, this is... people actually believe this. People actually, and quite intelligently, they are. Of course, it's not true, is it? It isn't true. And the argument is, oh no, human nature, you know, you're arguing against him. You can't change society. Now, I haven't met any of you before, except for Ben and Manuela, and I've never been to your home, and I don't know your parents, but you know, I can imagine the type of conversation that would take this. Let's say that you went to your parents and you said, well, I listened to Alan Woods, this marvellous speaker in Oxford, he completely convinced me, and I decided to be a Marxist and a revolutionary, and I want to change the world. What would your parents say? Now, let me hazard a guess. What they might say is something like this. No, don't do this, son or daughter, don't do this. Don't waste your lives. I used to think that when I was your age, but I got older and wiser and I understood. You can't change the world, it's all utopia, you see. Can't do this, you know. You can't change society, you can't change human nature. You hear these arguments? They're familiar to you, they're very familiar. Let me tell you something, by the way. Do not believe that people get older and wiser. Don't believe this. Many people get older and more stupid. You take it from me. Don't believe this. You know. And yes, you can't change human nature, really. Let me tell you something. Human nature has changed many times in the course of the last million years. And in the last 10,000. Many, many times. You know, there was a time when our ancestors were cannibals. I suppose some of you, any vegetarians here? No. Now, some of my best friends are vegetarians, you know, and they inform me that it is quite possible to have a healthy diet on the basis, without meat, on the basis of nuts and stuff like this, you know. And I believe it. I don't disbelieve it. It's a respectable argument. There's only one small problem with that, you see, and it is this. About 3 million years ago, on the savannah of eastern Africa, there were not many health shops open. You know, they were rather in short supply. And therefore, our ancestors ate anything. Anything. Usually dead bodies that had been hanging around for quite a while. Stone tools gave them superiority because they could open up the skins of these dead animals. What a thought, eh? And of course, meat being in short supply, it's a very handy way of getting protein meat. And of course, you did anything, including your granny. When she passed away, we got to leave, she could put it in the pot. that woman would think it was not necessarily such a bad idea. I mean, what's worse, putting your granny in the ground where she would be devoured by all sorts of unpleasant creatures, or getting the family run a nice little circle, giving the old girl a good send-off, and in the process have a good feed, you know? Think about it. But you see, now, at a certain stage, I'm just imagining a situation within it, among this crowd of cannibals. Some guy got up, like Alex, you see, got up and he said, "Now listen, comrades, I've been thinking about this, and I've come to the conclusion that it's not right to eat people. You know, this is not a good thing. This is quite immoral, you know." What a storm of indignation there would be. Can you imagine it? What are you talking about? Are you crazy? Stop eating people. We've always had people. What are you talking about? It's our tradition to eat. We have a culture of eating people. As a matter of fact, it's human nature to eat people. You're going against human nature. You understand? But of course, at a certain stage, people abandon cannibalism. And then they instead of eating war prisoners of war, they put them to work as slaves. Now, this is progress. Which would you rather be, Alex? Would you rather be devoured or put to work as a slave? Bit better. Yeah. Bit of progress there. Now, from our opinion, from our modern perspectives, slavery, of course, is a very detestable thing. It's almost as bad as cannibalism. And yet, let me tell you something. Hegel, who's a very great philosopher, he once said the following: "It is not so much from slavery as through slavery that man becomes free." That's an interesting thought. Think about it. To us, slavery is a very horrible, repellent thing. Okay? Where does all our culture come from? Mathematics, science, even economics. Where does it all come from? Rome, Greece, these were slave societies. All the culture of Rome, all the great were based upon slavery. If it wasn't for slavery, there'd be no Rome. There'd be no Colosseum, there'd be no Acropolis. There'd be no Agora, there'd be no democracy. Democracy was only for free citizens, not for slaves or women. And Aristotle justified that. He said, well, you know, slaves are not really people, because they don't have a soul. And women are the same. Women are not really people. They don't have a soul. You see, did you know that? Even Aristotle. By the way, he showed how advanced he was by asking the question, is it right to keep slaves? Nobody even asked the question. Because it's natural. It's human nature. Isn't it? Human nature has changed many times in the course of history. And capitalism, by the way, has only existed for 200 years. How long have we been around for? Human beings. Anyone know? Homo sapiens sapiens, to which most of us belong to, at least. Most people belong. I could see a few dubious cases in the cabinet, mainly, but that's a subject. How long has the human race been around? You can give different answers. 100,000 years, 150,000 years. Take it further back, if you wish. 200 years! That's all this wretched system has existed. Admittedly, it's achieved wonders, isn't it? All the progress has been achieved, and it's been fantastic. The whole thing has been speeded up. Yes, but you see, capitalism was responsible for enormous gains, enormous progress of science, technology, industry, agriculture. Yes, but it's my contention that, like many other systems in the past, like slavery, like feudalism, you see, these systems have existed. They're separate, they're different systems. And like a human being, they are born, they develop, they reach the peak, and then they enter into senile decay until eventually they're overthrown and they're made extinct. It is my contention that capitalism has now reached that stage. Proof, well, you know, I mean, it's not strictly scientific, but if you wanted an historical analogy, just look at the state of the world. When the Soviet Union collapsed, they promised us paradise on earth. They promised us a future of peace. Oh yes, they talked about a peace dividend. Do you remember that? The peace dividend. They wouldn't spend any money on arms. Do you know how much America spends on arms at the present time?
A lot.
More than $500,000 million a year. Okay, which the American taxpayer pays. Okay, they can't afford Medicare, by the way. They can't afford medicine. However, they can afford these astronomical bodies on producing weapons. The Iraq war itself is costing America, the latest figure I saw, $2 billion a week. Quite apart from the deaths and the horror and so on, this is another matter. I'm talking about economics, cold, factual economics. Peace, they said, peace, prosperity, thanks to the marvels of the free market economy, and of course, democracy, which is going to flourish everywhere. Well, you know, what I would say is this, you know, I haven't got a lot of time left to me, but just to say this. In order to understand what is happening in the world today, you do not have to be a genius, you do not have to have a PhD, you do not have to be a Marxist, you do not have to be even particularly intelligent. All you have to do is to switch your television off. That's all. Just switch on the television. Take a good, hard look at the kind of world which the capitalist system now offers you. It is, you know, if you were of a nervous disposition, it would be quite frightening. Peace, they said. Yes, peace. There's war after war after war. There's terrorism, which is a symptom, by the way, of a fundamental problem, which is spreading around the world like an uncontrollable epidemic. There is a general crisis, not just in the economy. Oh, by the way, what's all this stuff that they tell you in economic class? But pioneering spirit, you know, spirit that conquered the West, and in Britain, you know, an entrepreneur. What about Northern Rock? Did you follow that episode? Northern, just think about, I'll just pick this one instance of the pioneering spirit of how they don't need the state, of how they manage, how they take risks. Take risks. I could say something rude, but we're in polite company. Take risks. What risks? Look, when the British car industry was in trouble and the workers were asking for state assistance and so on, they were told, go and take a run and jump. They were allowed to sink, they were allowed to be unemployed, they're now cleaning floors or cleaning lavatories or working at chicken farms or unemployed, drawing state benefits. Okay? When the pensioners wanted to be reimbursed when they were robbed by one of these entrepreneurs, Maxwell of the Daily Mirror, the government told them to take a run and jump. It's your problem. Stand on your own 2 feet. That's what it's all about, isn't it? Capitalism. Stand on your own 2 feet. Defend yourself. Sort your own problems. Yes. The postmen are now asking. The post office, after all, is supposed to be nationalised. And it's clear what they want to do. They want to privatise it. They want to pick a fight with these workers, who are low-paid workers, and smash them and destroy the union. That's what it's about. Yeah. They've got no money for the postal workers. They've got no money for the nurses, doctors, and so on. Ah! But when it's a question of a bank, the bank is in trouble because they were engaged in speculation. They frittered away the money. There was no money left to pay the people whose money was in that bank. Therefore, for the first time in 150 years, you had a run on the bank in Northern Rock. What did they do? Immediately, Gordon Brown, who's supposed to be a Labour Prime Minister, comes running. They didn't wait. He comes running with a blank cheque. Here, take it. We'll repay all the money that you have. And by the way, the same guarantee was going to go to the whole banking system. There's one law for the worker. There's another law for the banker, as far as this is concerned. But the question I ask is this. After Northern Rock, after this farce of Northern Rock, where is the element of risk and of enterprise? Where is it? What's left? Nothing is left of it. It's a load of baloney. It's not. They come running to the state. That's the state is the taxpayer who pays the bill. No money for schools, no money for hospitals, plenty of money for the bankers, plenty of money for the war in Iraq. Now, you see, if you think this is all a thoroughly good thing and you approve of this and it's fine done, well, of course, I've got nothing else to say to you. But you see, I believe that a growing number of people, despite the enormous barrage of propaganda against socialism and so on, a growing number of people, I think, everywhere, including America, including the US. It's wrong. I mean, there's a lot of anti-Americanism among the European left. This is very bad. Yeah, no doubt. But I mean, in America, what I'm saying is there are different classes. The American worker, by the way, produces today, to go back to economics, The American worker, male or female, is producing 30% more than what they did 10 years ago. And the wages have not increased. They've not increased. And now, of course, people are faced in America, faced with a dire situation, with the housing crisis, with the... They encouraged, during the boom, a lot of quite poor people in America and Britain to take on mortgages which they couldn't afford, to buy houses they couldn't afford. Now they're being dispossessed, they're put on the street. Like so much garbage. Now, you see, all this is producing, in my opinion, a reaction against. People are asking, people are questioning this, also in America. People are questioning, is this right? Is this the kind of life that we want to lead? Is this the kind of society that we want? And the answer is coming loud and clear, no, it ain't. It isn't. And there must be an alternative, and there is an alternative. That alternative, friends and comrades, is called socialism. By which I mean, let me explain, a society which is based, an economy which is based on production for needs, production for the needs of the human race, and not production for the profits of a few. I believe that it's possible to have a planned economy. Incidentally, let me make another thing clear. I'm not in favor of nationalizing everything. That's not necessary. I'm a moderate, by the way. I'm not an extremist. I'm a very moderate sort of chap. And all I would propose for the United States and Britain is a socialist government that would nationalize the land, banks and the big monopolies, full stop. Not interested in the little corner shops, the small businesses, the small farmers. They can keep it. They don't decide anything. Everything is decided by these sectors, what are now in Bevan called the commanding heights of the economy. Because once you have the possession of these things, then you can have a rational plan. Now again, I'm running out of time, so I must be very brief, but just take one example. Everyone talks about green policies, green. They're all greens. George Bush is a green now. They all want to save the planet, apparently. Look, take just one question, the question of transport. How do you solve the problem of congestion? London is heavily congested. I see that Oxford also is heavily congested. It's a beautiful city, Oxford. Why should it be destroyed? Isn't it crazy, people going around, just one person in a car, isn't it? Of course it's crazy. What's the solution? Very simple. If you nationalise all forms of transport and had an integrated national transport system of rail, road, aircraft, canals which are not used, which since the 18th century they could be used to relieve congestion, you could actually ban all private cars from city centres, have wonderful car-free environments, and have free public, free and efficient public transport. Why not? Transport is a service, in my opinion. It's not simply for profit. People need to move about. Same as they need a house, they need education, all this should be catered for. There's no reason why that should not be the case. One final word. Socialism, of course, is internationalist by its very nature. I'm delighted we've got a real international in this room tonight. I'm delighted because socialism must be a worldwide phenomenon. Socialism in one country is not possible. You saw that in Russia. You see it again in China. It must be a worldwide phenomenon. It could start in one country. But it must be, what we're really fighting for is a socialist Britain as part of the socialist United States of Europe and as part of a socialist world. Comrades and friends, I believe that this is possible. You think it's difficult? Well, you know. Lots of things are difficult. No doubt when Jesus Christ started, how many did he start with? 12, wasn't it? And one of them turned out to be no good. The treasury ran off with the funds. This happens many times. Did you know that Judas Iscariot was the first bishop? Everyone thinks it was Peter. It wasn't Peter. I thought it was Judas Iscariot. The bishop was the treasurer, the man that looked after the funds. And it says in one of the Gospels, Judas Iscariot, the man that looked after the cash. So his behavior is quite predictable. With 12 people, he changed the world. You know, Muhammad started off with a tiny handful. The Bolsheviks started off with a tiny handful. You know, Lenin, as a matter of fact, during the First World War, let me tell you a little story, and with this I will finish. Lenin, a man that I admire very greatly, subject to a lot of calumny and slanders, you know, but he was a great optimist. He's always optimistic, but there's just one thing in his life. In the First World War, where, by the way, the workers of Europe were slaughtering each other, there were dictatorial regimes everywhere, everything was black, much, much blacker than what it is now. By comparison, Iraq is just a tea party. We're talking about a European war where Germans and British and Russians, Austrians, slaughtering each other. Where's the possibility of workers of the world unite? It's all utopian. It can't work. It's failed. Lenin was in exile in Switzerland. At that time, he was in contact with about 20 people in the world. He couldn't contact Russia. There was no internet in those days. All the communications were broken by the war. And he was giving a conference, as I'm giving it now, he was giving a conference to some Swiss young socialists. And he ended with the following words. He said, "Well, I'm an old man." Wasn't old, actually. He was younger than me. So, but that's what he said, anyway. He said, "I'm an old man, and I probably will never live to see the socialist revolution. Depends on you. Depends on the young people." You know, when he said those words, January 1970, a few weeks later, he received the news that the Tsar had been overthrown. 9 months later, the Bolsheviks were in power. The first socialist revolution in the world. And therefore, what I say is this. Of course, every great idea, every great movement starts with a minority. We're not afraid of that. You shouldn't be afraid either. What you must make your mind up is that we have to change this world. That we are determined to change this society, whether it's in Iran, which is very necessary, the United States, where there is an awakening now. You can see it. There is an awakening. People are looking for something, which wasn't the case before, or indeed in Britain, where we are. There's a general movement. What is required, however, that this movement must be equipped with the proper ideas, perspectives, philosophy, if you like, program, which in my view can only really be provided by what I call scientific socialism and Marxism. Comrades and friends, this is the only cause that is worth fighting for and giving your life for in the first decade of the 21st century.